This is the video we made in 1993 to celebrate Garth and Margie's work in Namibia that won the Goldman Prize.
The prohibition of the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the South African Communist Party, and a number of subsidiary organizations is being rescinded.
The government will Before the anti-apartheid reforms of the late 1980s, the South African government ostracized anyone with an opposing view. Two of those people were Garth Owen Smith and Margaret Jacobson. They chose to move north and west to Namibia. Namibia contains the world's oldest desert, the Coco Veld, home to two of the most endangered species on Earth, the desert elephant and the black rhinoceros. In the early 1980s, the rhino and the elephant were close to extinction. Poachers, lured by the lucrative black market, slaughtered these animals indiscriminately for their horns and tusks. The results were devastating. The elephant population fell from 1,000 to just 250. The rhino's fate was even worse, from 350 to less than 65. How is this possible? Namibia is one of the least populated places on Earth. Poachers could roam freely and kill at will.
With the very small number of people that we had in the area to try and control this poaching, it would be impossible to stop this poaching unless we got the help, the active participation of the local community, the people living in that area.
Profoundly affected by the wildlife massacre, Owen Smith, a conservationist, and Jacobson, an anthropologist, started meeting with the local Himba, Herrera, and Damara residents to support a conservation effort. As newcomers, they sought to gain local trust. They asked for the local views, concerns, and suggested solutions to ending the brutal poaching. In 1983, the Auxiliary Game Guard was devised. It's an unarmed network of local patrols. These semi-nomadic herdsmen continue their daily lives, but at the same time, watch the arid countryside for poachers. The system has been a dramatic success.
Instead of just government and their agents enforcing the law, we have the community playing an active role, and this team that we built up was, I think, the way that this illegal hunting was brought under control.
Today, poaching is nearly non-existent. The populations of the desert elephant, the black rhinoceros, and many other species are on the rise. And with more animals come more tourists. Large groups are traveling here for a chance to see some of the magnificent wildlife and landscape. Recognizing this, Jacobson started the Puros Project as a way for these newly empowered conservationists to benefit from their efforts.
We had two tour operators in the area, and we basically approached them for a tourist levy, a sort of per head tax, to give to the people in whose area they were operating, seeing the people as caretakers of the wildlife.
Like the Game Guard program, the Puros Project is regarded as a model, a remarkable example of a community-based conservation program. And as Garth and Margie see it, the community deserves the credit.
We're part of a team.
I think that's the whole basis of what has been achieved in that area. It's certainly not being individuals. We've all played a role, and if we can claim any personal attributes, it would simply be that we have stuck in there.
For outstanding environmental achievement in Africa, a 1993 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Garth Owen Smith and Margaret Jacobson of World's End, Namibia.
Let's just run through whether we have any lessons for Greater Yellowstone. We wouldn't presume to say we have. This is where we come from. This is right on the edge of the country above Angola, just at the edge where Angola is. It's a small, medium-sized African country with a very small population, and we're only 3.5 times bigger than the state of Wyoming. But it's not all desert. We have some wonderful tropical and subtropical areas. This is in what used to be called Caprivi, now Zambezi, where there's some wonderful rivers, the Zambezi, the Chobe. This is one of Steve Fuller's pictures. And I have to say, I think our buffalo look a lot happier. You've got these critters. We've got these, and I'm afraid that it's a donkey that these lions are eating, and we'll get to these sort of problems later. But we're not going to be showing you lots of animal pictures. We're going to be talking about what we regard as the cutting edge of conservation in Africa, and quite frankly, the most of the world, and that is people being directly involved, feeling a sense of ownership over the resources, and certainly in our case, Africa, Namibia, where people are poor, benefiting from natural resources. We're focusing on the 42% of the country that is known as communal land. We're not looking at the national parks, nor are we looking at private land, but 42% is where the majority of people live. And how did we go from this, where people were alienated? People versus government, well, you've heard some of it with the film. This was taken a few years ago. We went from that to this, where this was a rhino very much alive being translocated into a conservancy. And you can see for yourselves the expressions on the faces of those Himba people, how pleased they were to receive rhino back into their area. And simply, and this is a rather silly slide from some conference I gave once, this is how what was achieved happened. Simply linking natural resource management to economic development to the growth of democracy. Those three factors coming together enabled us to do what the team has done. Namibian CBNRM, community-based natural resource management, is based on very sound natural resource management and management principles, legal rights and responsibilities devolved to the lowest level. In this case, we're talking about what we call conservancies, not very different to yours, community-based organizations made up by the people who live on the land. They, in return for forming a conservancy, get ownership over resources in their defined area. And of course, there have to be incentives. People are poor, and we stress social empowerment as much as economic empowerment, but there are jobs, there's income to these conservancies, and real enhancement of cultural and social values. And just briefly, because you also have conservancies and ours are so different, these are local areas where a group of people decide to form a legal conservancy, and they zone it for different uses, farming, it's not a game reserve, mixed farming and tourism, core wildlife, emergency grazing. It's up to the people themselves, and it's very empowering for them to be able to take control and, in a way, mediate government services that come in. To form a conservancy, it's quite complicated, and the organization that we used to head up has assisted many communities to go through the various hoops to become conservancies. These are some of the things they have to do. It's been left very loose because we're a culturally very diverse country, speaking 22 different languages. Our organization speaks 11 of them. So a Himba herding, semi-nomadic herding group will form a representative committee very differently from perhaps a hunter-gatherer sand group or a fishing community might. They need to come up with a plan of how they're going to manage their wildlife and also a land use plan. And this is protected local residents because it means outsiders can't come in and do what they like on the land, as happened before. There is now a plan in place, and if somebody violates that plan, potentially the conservancy can take that person's to court. And this has happened, and they've They've won their cases. Equitable benefit distribution plan. Money comes into the conservancies through tourism and hunting, and how the conservancy committee plans to distribute its money needs to be decided in advance. And of course, there are meetings and members get together to discuss what they want to do with the money. As everybody here who's worked with more than three people at a time will know, that no community activity ever runs smoothly. There are obviously conflicts and issues. At any given time, 5 to 10% of the conservancies are perhaps not managing their money correctly, having problems. But overall, this has been the result. Wildlife has thrived, increased more or less 10% in most areas. We've just hit a five-year drought in the northwest, so wildlife numbers have plummeted, but they're already recovering after rains. In the northeast and other parts of Namibia where there are conservancies, wildlife is doing incredibly well. The economy is diversified. There are lodges, there are campsites, there are community-owned businesses such as selling myrrh, which is a resin that is exuded naturally out of Camphora wildea. And this is a multi-million dollar product that Estelade Body Shop purchases from conservancies. So it's made a difference to the life of people. Not enough of a difference yet. It's a work in progress, but things are looking good. And an interesting side effect of this is that because people are organized, mobilized, it's a social structure, they are able to make an input into national events. They're able to basically manage their lives in a much more proactive way. Today we have, as you can see, there are 84 of these entities. The CCA is a residence trust, which is inside one of our national parks. There's community forests, and we've even got two fish reserves on the boundary with Zambia and Angola. And this is important for communities across transboundary to coordinate and cooperate. And remarkably, one in seven Namibians lives inside a conservancy. I think it's the biggest social movement since the anti-apartheid movement in our country. We've got double the area we had before under wildlife habitat now, which is amazing. We're now over 40% of Namibia. A lot of it is desert and not inhabited, but over 40% of Namibia is now wildlife friendly. People interested in money, 2.3 billion Namibian dollars invested in the program over the years, and 7.1 billion NNI return, net national income return, which is a 32% return. Pretty good in anybody's book. And just to give you an idea, we're a small country. That 7.1 billion is 4% of our GDP. About 140 million goes locally to people and in conservancies in different ways. And there are thousands of new local jobs that have been created, making a big difference because people don't need to go and squat in town. We always like to look beyond money. There's much more involved here. And it's been very important that people's rights have been formalized and operationalized. When you have a valuable resource like myrrh, the Umumbiri plant that the Himba women have collected for centuries, if it got out that this is a multi-million dollar marketable product, you could have people coming from the capital and from town and taking this from people. But with the conservancy structures, this can no longer happen. The conservancy can control who harvests their resources. Another important side effect has been, because the conservancies help people to organize themselves, they have a collective voice, and they can have a say into what's happening in the capital. Normally in developing African countries, it's all about the capital and the political elite in Windhoek, in town. Now we have conservancies and a representative conservancy association able to make an input into a new tourism bill or whatever's happening. They're a very powerful lobby. And in our country, probably in your country too, politicians follow. They don't lead. Social organization is drastically improved. When we had a polio epidemic 7 or 8 years ago, the World Health Organization came in to help us. And they were incredibly impressed every time they went into a conservancy because you could see the organization to get everybody there and inoculated. Most important, post-apartheid, post-colonial, rural, poor Africans, there's a vision for the future and real self-esteem and incredible capacity that's been built. Men and women can now stand up, speak in public, and it's been a remarkable change that we've seen over the 25 years. There's a lot of cooperation and partnerships, and conflict management is handled well. And before I hand over to Garth, who's going to unpack community conservation a bit, I just want to tell you a modern rhino story, because conservation's never finished. It's never a done job. It's always a work in progress. And we knew since the early 2000s that the massive rhino poaching that was taking place in South Africa and Zimbabwe was going to spread to Namibia, where we have the second largest black rhino population in Africa. When we were young, most of us were young, in the 70s, there were 100,000 black rhinos in Africa. Today, there are less than 5,000. So the current poaching is devastating. We braced ourselves, 2010, 2011, we knew it was coming. Some of the NGOs got experts from South Africa to come and tell us how to do it. After all, they were losing 3 rhino a day, so they were obviously experts. We got some of our old community game guards out of retirement, and we got them to come and mentor the younger generations of conservancy game guards who'd never experienced poaching. We also, a really important thing happened, the conservancies asked for help of the NGOs and of the government, and our sister organization, the Save the Rhino Trust, made a great decision not to invest in more staff, more NGO staff, but to invest in the conservancies. We were truly aligned, my organization, IADNC and SRT, and conservancy rhino rangers started being appointed. Sure enough, 2012, we lost our first rhino in a conservancy. Communities caught the culprits within 24 hours, recovered the horn. In spite of that remarkable situation, the response of government, as more rhinos were poached, not in conservancies, the poachers then turned to our very large concession areas neighboring the conservancies where nobody lives. In spite of that, the government turned inwards. None of these government officials were in office in the early days when we stopped a massive commercial rhino poaching epidemic involving South African Defence Force, government officials, local people. They'd forgotten. Nobody remembers history. And they turned inwards. It was a police and a government issue. They kept the conservancies, the NGOs, the communities out. We called it the yellow tape era. They would police would come in, put a yellow tape around a rhino that had been dead for 2 years. And even though a conservancy member would come and say, look at those tracks, we can follow those. We know who owns those boots. The police were suspicious of communities and alienated communities. It was a dreadful situation. There was not a single arrest while we stood by and watched 15% of our rhino killed. This is up to 2015. 1 year, 22 rhino died in our backyard. Eventually, Garth and I decided enough. We called on the Goldman Foundation and said, give us, please, a small grant, which they did, a fraction of the money, I think it was $25,000, fraction of the money that was being used in massive anti-poaching efforts by the police and government. And what we did was get hold of 35 key traditional leaders and say, you or your fathers stopped the poaching 30 years ago. You're going to stand by and watch this happen again. Garth and the current director of our organization, John K. Carsona, took out these men for 4 days into the rhino ranges, showed them what was going on, and because we believe in teamwork and cooperation, we had the police and the government with us. And on the last day, we had an action planning session. And the authorities were forced to admit, when they heard these traditional leaders make a commitment to stop the poaching, they were forced to realize they couldn't keep community out any longer. So we forged teams. The elders asked for a four-day meeting. The story's nearly finished. They asked for a four-day meeting, and they said 2 days, they don't want any NGOs or government involved, just all the conservancy leaders, all these young people, educated young people, who are running the 13 conservancies that have rhinos. They want to talk to them. And for 2 days, they gave them a history lesson. They taught them what had happened in the last 30 years and how there wouldn't be any wildlife in these communal areas if it wasn't for the grandfathers and the fathers. And amazingly, many of these youngsters didn't know the history. I can think of one young chairman of a conservancy who stood up on the last day when we were allowed in and said, "I haven't said a word yet, not because I wasn't listening, but because I was learning so much. And I honestly didn't know how much we have to thank our parents and our grandparents. And now I understand what it means to be chairman of a conservancy, and it's very, a very heavy weight on my shoulder." Anyway, 2015, this happened. We lost three rhino that year, but the point is there were arrests every single time. Since then, our main project area, we haven't lost a single rhino. We have boots on the ground 24/7, thanks to the Conservancy Rhino Rangers, who are passionate and committed. It's their rhinos. And the sighting of rhinos during these monitoring events has gone up 600%. It's an extremely good situation. On the edge of our project area, on the edge of a tourism concession, there was a problem area where 11 rhino were killed about 18 months ago, big breakthrough, arrests, and there's been no poaching in that part of Namibia for the last year and a half, which I can tell you is remarkable in Africa. It's not happening in South Africa. It's not happening in Tosha National Park. But with bringing the whole team together, passion and commitment of communities, we've achieved this situation.
We retired from our NGO. Nearly 9 years ago now. So public speaking is not something we've done much of recently. We need a bit of, to have a bit of patience with us, and particularly me. Well, here we are in North America, pretty much your country. And I think you can see that, the environment is very different. But there's one thing in common. As you all know from the increased numbers of people going to Yellowstone, the overcrowding, and in our case in Namibia, the number of tourists coming to Namibia is just showing once again how valuable wildlife and wild places are to the world. They're valuable, but the real question is, who gets the benefits? And a little short history, going back even further than Margie. Under colonial governments, wildlife belonged to the state. National parks were created, managed by the state. And in Namibia's case, wildlife numbers, both on private farmland and on the communal land, they're both equally about just over 40%, and then the national parks were about 16%. The numbers of wildlife were crashing on, let's call them what they were. They were white farms, commercial farms, that saw no value in wildlife at all. As was said, when I worked in those areas way back in the 70s, if I'd go to a farm, he would say to me, "I feed these animals, whether it is oryx, springbuck, or zebra, for the whole year. But if I want to shoot one to make some meat biltong, in our case, for my family, I have to go to the magistrate and ask for a permit, which I have to pay for. So this wildlife has no value to me, and it, as far as I'm concerned, if it wasn't on my farm, I'd be very happy." The Namibian Zimbabwe and South African governments took a real risk in 1975, and gave the ownership of wildlife, not all wildlife, but what was called huntable game, back to the farmers. From that year, wildlife numbers on private land, freehold land, started climbing. Today it is six times what it was. But it didn't happen on the communal land. Nobody cared about wildlife there. It wasn't seen as a resource of any value to the local people, and they themselves had the same situation. It was no value to them. So they, in league with people who were making the real money out of it, wildlife had been wiped out in the communal areas. And nobody saw any future for it there. We were, in the early days, at about the time we won the award for the Goldman Environmental Prize for Africa, we believed wildlife had a value. Farmers had changed their attitude, and it needed to be done for the communal farmers as well. Which a few years after our prize, in 1996, government legislation was changed to give local communities the rights, both hunting and tourism rights, in the areas, if they formed conservancies, like Margie said, and then the responsibility to manage the wildlife. If we look at the broad picture today, wildlife numbers have increased dramatically on communal land, but there are still big issues. And poaching is not really an issue today. It's not the big issue. Just for a few species that are really threatened. The real pressures that we face is conflict and competing land use. In this picture, it's an area that was very good wildlife habitat. It's now being slashed and burned, and it'll be crops, and all the problems that come with crops, because they will be a target for elephants. So we have to look at a different problem today, not the poaching. The poaching is a minor issue. The big pressure is coming with increasing human populations to move into what was wildlife habitat. And unless wildlife can have a real benefit, then that's going to continue happening. And the area that wildlife's available to, that is available to wildlife, is going to shrink. Anyway, we have been working with government. We've been working against government. Thanks to supporters like the Goldman Foundation, we were able to win at times, not always. We've also worked against communities, particularly the elite, who want to capture whatever benefits there are coming from wildlife, the elite within those areas. But it is very much a matter of sitting down and talking to people. It's not drones or military operations. So we thought that what may be of a little bit of use is for us to look at some of the basic principles that we've used in our more than 30 years that we've worked with communities. And the same principles apply when you are working with government or the private sector. The very first thing that you have to do, and that is develop a relationship. A good relationship with whoever, even if they are your opponents. I think Nelson Mandela taught us that at the time that South Africa, just before it had its first democratic elections. And building relationships is not about talking to people. Building relationships is about listening to people, hearing what they say, hearing their perspective, and respecting it, be it a rural community or a government official. The next step that we've always found really important is, first of all, for everybody to understand the issues. And that's often meant that we have taken the leaders, or government into the area that's under dispute and shown them the area so that if one's discussing it, you must know it. You must have been there and seen it. And we often take groups out for 3 or 4 days camping in the area, as Margie mentioned, in terms of those traditional leaders who were unaware of what was happening. When you've done that, then we have looked at the different parties, the different stakeholders, and said, what is your vision for the future? How do you want to see this land or this community or your community develop in the future? And the surprising thing every time has been that even if it's government officials on the one side who are disputing land or any other issue with local communities, when they look at the, when we, people come out with their visions, it's nearly always 90, at least 80, 90% the same. People have the same vision for the future. The government wants to conserve the wildlife. So do the local people. It's just how. There will always be some areas of conflict, and those we list and those we discuss and negotiate. Now, a lot of ways that governments work today, they consult people and feel, well, we've been out, we've got a plan, we're going to go to the people and we're going to tell them our plan. And the people don't have a better plan. Maybe they haven't even thought too much about it. So they say, yes, yes, we accept your plan. But they haven't bought into it. It's not their plan. So for us, it's really a matter of negotiation, going in without a plan, sitting down with your opposition or other stakeholders and formulating from scratch a plan to address the issues that you don't all agree on. Obviously, one tries to build partnerships. Getting the, as Margie mentioned, the police and the Conservancy Rhino Rangers and the NGOs all working together to stop rhino poaching. The other issue, it's rights. But we would like to call it ownership. Who owns that resource? Who does it belong to? And how do people feel about it? If something belongs to you, you look after it. You take responsibility for it. If it belongs to the government, it's the government's responsibility. So however you can do that in your case, in your area, whether it's legal rights or just whether it's de jure or de facto rights, people must feel both the plan and the resources are ours, jointly with government possibly, but they must feel they're ours. When it comes to action, it's very important that the action is done by all parties. Not just say, all right, now we've got a plan and now we all feel ownership and leave it to the government to do the work. We saw what happened with the rhino poaching. They never got any arrests. Like every party, every stakeholder must participate in the actions that are needed. Okay, and lastly, and deliberately lastly, is benefits. There are always costs, particularly to living with wildlife. It costs a lot. Elephants raid your crops, lions kill your livestock. There's a cost with having wildlife grazing on your land where your cattle are living. So those costs are important, and they must be covered. There are also the costs of protecting wildlife. Those conservancy game guards that Margie mentioned, Conservancy Rhino Rangers, are paid by their conservancies. They need transport. There are costs that have to be paid by the conservancies. There's the last point on benefits. Today, big tourism companies are making the money out of by building lodges and using communal land as where they're working on. they're making a lot of money. And unless there is a fair share going back to the local community, over and above trying to cover the costs, the community's got to feel we are also benefiting. That lodge doesn't belong to Wilderness Safaris. It's our lodge. We are in partnership with Wilderness Safaris, and we are sharing benefits and all other more social benefits of preferential employment, training. That's all part of the contracts that are formed with the private sector. That's the way we've worked, but nothing's perfect, and we have challenges. And we'll always have challenges because government doesn't easily give up control. So the moment you back off on something, government will take will try and take control back from the local communities. It's an ongoing battle, and it'll probably always be an ongoing battle. That's what governments are about. They want to control. So that's a constant fight that we have to make sure that the communities are in control of their land and their resources. And here again, I must say, professional conservationists and academics are also a major threat to us. I'm sure there's lots of you there in the audience. And the threat that they pose is that many, if not most of them, do not believe that local communities with limited resources, limited education, can actually protect wildlife. Only professionals can do that. So we have a constantly also keeping the professionals back. Don't take over. The communities can do it better than you. When they need help, they'll ask for it. A technical support, and that works great. Yeah, well, of course, we all know about the social media. Social media can be, I don't think there are many professions today that aren't faced with the onslaught of social media. And we are in conservation. People in Australia will tell us how to manage our lions. People, often anonymous, will have big campaigns about some policy that is being applied in Namibia. And let's remember, managing wildlife is not an exact science. You can't count your zebra. You have to get estimates. You have to manage your zebra populations just like you have to manage your livestock populations on the farm. At times, that means reducing their numbers. Predators can get out of control. And as particularly in deserts where you don't have the nice balance of nature that we all like to think about, in a desert, it's boom and bust. Animal populations go up, and then animal populations decline. When the prey species decline in that period, lion and other predator numbers increase. When the rains come again, after a drought, the remaining wildlife disperses. High lion population, dispersed wildlife, and suddenly we have lions starving. In national parks, they starve. And the lion, while I worked in Etosha, at the end of the big drought we had in the 80s, we had 500 lions. 3 years later, we had 180 lions. They died of starvation. The difference in communal land is when the wildlife disperses because we've now had good rains, there's an alternative for the lions, and that is the local people's livestock. And the issue of human-wildlife conflict, particularly what we're facing now at the end of a drought, of huge numbers, thousands of head of cattle being killed by lions, and many thousands of small stock being killed by lion, cheetah, leopard, and other predators. So our actual lion population is out of balance. But if a single lion is shot by a farmer, or because it's habitually taking livestock, the social media is on our backs and on the government's back. How could you allow that? How could you allow that lion to be shot to? Not about how many cattle have been killed by that overpopulation of lions, But we will have to live with the social media, I'm sure, for many years to come. That, so human-wildlife conflict, which I've touched on, is another very big issue. Conservancies are farming areas. They're not national parks. Communal conservancies actually make up a greater part of Namibia than our national parks. Our national parks are now 17%. The communal conservancies within that 40% of communal land make up 20%. 50% of the communal areas are conservancies. They have provided the land for wildlife to live on outside of the parks instead of them being confined to a few parks. But they come with a cost to the farmers, both in predation of livestock and elephants damaging crops. And the wildlife has to pay the costs of that through being harvested, through trophy hunting and other forms of hunting. Trophy hunting being simply the most, from a conservancy's point of view, if you have got an overpopulation of lions, let's use that as an example, and you take one of those male lions, you can get $20,000 for that lion. That'll go directly to the community through the conservancy. That $20,000 will pay for 50 head of cattle killed, whereas the farmer would have had the right to shoot that lion himself, but they would have got nothing back. But through trophy hunting, they get $20,000 back, can pay and enable the conservancy to compensate their farmers. Government gives a bit of help, but basically the compensation that's done for livestock losses is done by the conservancies out of their own income from tourism and hunting. We've mentioned government control, professional conservation. It's not believing that local people can actually manage wildlife without their help, or with a little bit of their help. Social media, we all know. The private sector has been, certainly in the beginning, very reluctant to come to the table. They have felt they had the right to set up businesses in communal areas and employ local people. Now, that's where it had been before conservancies, and they didn't see why they should change. So we've had a lot of the big companies. We've had major fights with them, probably more than with any. I, personally, I was often not welcome at meetings, just trying to get the private sector to recognize you are carrying out your business on land that doesn't belong to you. Your big attraction for your tourists is the wildlife that the local people are protecting for the benefit of your guests. You have to contribute to that. And that's been an ongoing fight. Private sector, I think I'd written it private sector greed, but it, and it doesn't just apply to lodge operators. It applies in many ways because of Southern Africa's history. Local communities, local black communities were not regarded as equal members of the society, and now they are. They control both the government, but they also control the land. Through conservancies, they have the rights. So the private sector is being forced to come to the table and negotiate with them. So we're getting there, but there's still a lot of private sector people that will take a long time before they really buy into it. Actually, I think we've already discussed human-wildlife conflicts, and this picture is just to show living with wolves. Yes, they cause kill sheep, I've no doubt, kill calves. Living with elephants is a different story. They kill human beings. And it's remarkable what the people living in the communal lands, in the conservancies, are prepared to put up with living with lions and elephants that come into their homes. The elephants come into their homesteads to just come and drink from their water source very peacefully. The people living in the village will just tell their kids, which they've told long ago, just keep out the way of the elephants. They'll drink and quietly go away. I don't think there are any other places in Africa that do that. And I just go back to saying why that is the case is because the local communities see those elephants as theirs, not the government's. They're their elephants, and as they've said to us many times, both regarding elephants and lions, if they belong to the government must either move them or we will shoot them. If they belong to us, we will manage them. Thank you.
I'm not going to go into the story because I think we need time to have a bit of a discussion. This was simply, I was asked by Hope Mountain to talk about activating Indigenous knowledge practically, and we've been able to do this through Indigenous fire practices in part of our country. And in fact, it turns out that Indigenous burning contributes to climate change mitigation. I'm not going to go there, but Australia has proved this. So it's remarkable, and believe you me, Indigenous people have a lot to teach the developed world about burning, including in California. I'm not going to look at what this thing, we can talk about it in questions. What I really want to just go on to at the end is make the point that community-based action goes beyond conservation, beyond wildlife. All these different aspects of life, of challenges, community action is what has made a difference. We can give you examples. I'm sure you all know that. And then finally, this is a bit of an advertisement. If anybody ever wants to come to Namibia, this is one of the fruits of community conservation. It is a Himba-owned safari company, 100% owned by 5 conservancies, but run by a very experienced technical crew. And it's a great way to support conservation and communities in Namibia.